The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsensewealth.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The war drums continued to be louder this week as Israel orchestrated a limited missile attack against Iran following last week's drone and missile attack against Israel. Both countries are trying to calm tensions after trading missiles in an attempt to dial down tensions between the two. The Dow eked out minor gains for the week as money rotates out of high-priced stocks, and the Nasdaq suffered its worst performance since 2022. It lost 5.5% for the week, while the S&P 500's losses were 3.1%. Wars, the return of inflation, overpriced stocks, and worries over corporate earnings are now weighing on the minds of nervous investors. Rising oil prices is adding another worry, with Brent crude prices jumping from $87 to $91 overnight. By the end of the day today, prices receded back but remain elevated. As volatility index spikes, investors are looking at hedges from reverse index funds to puts in precious metals. And speaking of precious metals, gold prices closed out the week at record levels on Friday, while silver looks to be going parabolic, advancing from a low of $22 a little over a month ago to Friday's close at $28.84, with an explosive upside as a massive short position in silver is now at risk. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. My special guest is Bob Coleman from Idaho Armored Vaults as we discuss Bob's new article, How Does the Market System Manage the Silver Price? We'll talk about the unwinding of metal derivatives at banks and what that means for gold prices, while Costco is selling $100 million a month in gold, and who that big buyer of gold is, and myriad reasons why gold continues to advance to new records never seen before. I've also posted a new article on our Financial Sense website drawing parallels to the 17th century France after the death of Louis XIV and the U.S. today. But first, let's find out the stories moving the market this week with Ryan Poplava.
It was a harsh week for stocks, with all the major indices now trading below their respective 50-day moving averages, indicating an intermediate correction may be well underway. Tech was hit hard after some bellwether earnings and comments were announced by ASML and Taiwan Semiconductor. Despite ongoing geopolitical tensions in the Middle East, crude oil prices retreated. And finally, Treasury yields climbed to recent highs for the year, while Fed Chair Powell's comments seemed to affirm a later start to Fed's cuts, if any. Initially, stocks rose Monday after the Iranian drone attack appeared limited and largely thwarted by air defenses, but the rally was faded with selling picking up after Israel's chief of staff said there will be a response to Iran's attack over the weekend. That response came Friday with a strike on an Air Force base close enough to nuclear facilities to send the message, we can hit you where it hurts. The media is describing the attack as limited and proportionate, as it did not cause significant damage that would warrant a response or escalation. Iran has affirmed that its military and nuclear sites remain secure. Crude oil was up only slightly on the news. On the economic front, robust retail sales indicate sustained consumer spending strength. March saw a 0.7% increase, surpassing the expected 0.4% increase, while February's figures were revised upward from 0.6% to 0.9%. Excluding automotive and gasoline sales, there was a notable 1% surge, with February's numbers also revised upwards. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has shifted his stance on inflation, no longer seeing it trending downward, and that restrictive policy needs more time to work. These sales figures, coupled with Powell's comments, have pushed expectations for the first rate cut as far back as September. However, March saw a 15% decline in housing starts, though permits decreased by a more moderate 4.3%, while existing home sales continued to be weak, all pointing to a weak spring selling season. Initial jobless claims remain low at 212,000, suggesting a resilient labor market. Additionally, the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Manufacturing Index unexpectedly rose to a two-year high, while there was a small recovery effort in the New York Empire State reading, which confirms the ongoing recovery of U.S. manufacturing. The technology sector was hit rather hard with ongoing stock weakness and from the help of cautious comments from ASML and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. ASML was down 7.1% post-earnings after reporting a weaker-than-expected Q1 bookings and guided below consensus for the current quarter. Taiwan Semi beat expectations and raised guidance. However, the company modified its forecast for 2024 overall chip growth from more than 10% to just 10% growth. If you dig deep into the report, their comments are mainly regarding overall chip growth hurt by cell phone seasonality, but AI revenues for the company are expected to grow at a 50% compounded annual growth rate across the next 5 years. Growth for Taiwan Semi slowed in both the smartphone, automotive, and Internet of Things segments. Another thing to note is that the upside in AI servers spells downside for traditional servers. Still, the weaker outlook for semiconductors from both companies took some of the froth out of chip stocks this week, with the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index down 9% for the week and AI champion NVIDIA down more than 12% for the week. More on the earnings front, UnitedHealth beat earnings expectations after its rare miss in the previous quarter, exceeded revenue expectations, and affirmed its 2024 outlook despite setbacks, lifting the stock 5.2% following its earnings release. United Airlines beat expectations and raised guidance on the quarter, confirming results from Delta Airlines that travel demand remains robust. The banks topped estimates for the most part, with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley leading the pack due to gains in investment banking, while Bank of America and PNC both had earnings decline. Online brokers Charles Schwab and Interactive Brokers had positive responses to their results, with Charles Schwab announcing client assets at a record $9.11 trillion. Tesla hit a new 52-week low this week on news of its Cybertruck recall, layoff announcement of more than 10% of its employees, and announced departure of two key executives. The company will report earnings next Tuesday. Earnings announcements will kick it up a notch over the next couple of weeks. For this week, it was a mixed bag with profit-taking hitting hard in tech after ASML and Taiwan Semiconductor posted their earnings and comments on the industry. Defensive sectors, utilities, and consumer staples were up on the week, while technology and consumer discretionary were hit the hardest. The 10-year Treasury yield hit 4.61% after closing last week at 4.49% as inflationary expectations continue to rise and rate cut expectations are tempered on Powell's comments and stronger economic conditions this week. Despite ongoing tensions in the Middle East, oil prices fell. Maybe as some expect, the tit-for-tat response pace may slow in the weeks ahead, with both sides claiming near-term victory. That's it for this week's wrap-up. Up next, this week's guest, Bob Coleman.
We're in an inflationary regime, and even within an inflationary regime, you can have periods of relatively seemingly kind of low inflation, or certainly lower than it was at the peaks of the inflation. And my view has always been that once the genie is out of the bottle, if you like, inflation is very hard to get back into a low and stable regime.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
If I was to ask you what was the best performing asset over the last 5 years, you'd probably think stocks, AI stocks, things like Microsoft, the Magnificent Seven. Well, there's another asset class that is actually the best performing asset, and it would be a surprise. And that asset is gold. Over the last 5 years, gold is up 81%, and the S&P is up 76%. As gold once again becomes a currency in its historical role. Well, let's talk about the gold and silver market. Joining me on the program is Bob Coleman. He is head of goldsilvervault.com. Bob, I want to talk about last Friday. We had you on a couple of weeks ago, but last Friday, we saw gold hit 2,500, and then we saw silver hit 30 for a brief moment, and then things tumbled. Let's talk about what happened and what the CME did with margin requirements and interest.
I appreciate you having me on the show. We had on that day, you had the, as prices become more volatile, it's very common for the futures markets to raise margin requirements in a way to try to settle down volatility, meaning it's just more expensive to hold a contract. That's what raising margin requirements basically are. And so players are a little bit less leveraged, so the price movements don't affect their position as quickly. But what you had about a 6.8% increase in margin requirements on gold and about a 12% increase in margin requirements on silver, and that was enough to initially, it was enough to squeeze a little bit of the longs to the downside, but then all of a sudden it lifted higher. And when you raise margin requirements, it affects not just the long positions, but also the short positions as well, because you have to pony up more margin if you're short and the market's going against you. So what ultimately you had is you had a squeeze start to develop, and then gold kind of made this sort of double top type action, I guess you could say. There's an old adage where, you know, traders will say, if you see a double top, you sell a double top. Well, you kind of had that sort of hit the markets, and you saw basically profit taking ensued. And with the advent of higher margin and a lot of these players, you know, you got to remember the CTAs, commodity trading advisors and so forth, were building up some very big long positions going into that week. A lot of them just got liquidated or just basically took profits. Because you have to remember, when you're trading on margin, it's a much different trading or position you're taking rather than buying physical metal and holding for the long term. On margin, you have to be really sensitive to these price movements, because it can wipe out your profit and put you into a loss scenario very quickly. So people are much more sensitive to that. Not just the paper markets, you know, acting the way they normally do. It's just that when you see these margin hikes, it tends to make things a little bit tighter, where people don't have, maybe the volatility tends to hit them and force them to react quicker, I guess you could say.
Now, I want to talk about an article that we're going to be talking about and posting on our website. How does the market system manage the silver price? So if we go back to 1980, gold hit 800, silver hit 50. Since then, gold has hit new record highs. We did it in 2011. We're doing it again right now. But silver is selling at, what, 60% of what it was 40 years ago. So let's talk about the role of ETFs. And you have a diagram in this article that our listeners are going to want to read on this site, because it makes it easier to understand how this manipulation takes place. So let's begin with what we call the APs, or authorized participants, and how they interact with ETFs between buyers and sellers.
Yeah, the advent of ETFs, or exchange-traded funds, have become wildly popular. In fact, I think I read a statistic where there's actually now more ETFs out there than actual underlying stocks, but that's another story in and of itself. The exchange-traded funds, and the ones we're going to refer to here, for example, is the SLV, which is the largest silver ETF out there. So basically, the background is the silver ETF owns underlying physical metal held in London and New York, and investors can basically buy price representation of silver through this ETF. So if the price of silver goes up, the ETF goes up. If the price of silver goes down, the ETF goes down. What it's done, I think, in this growth of the financial system, especially since the 2008 crisis, is that a lot more participants have gone to ETFs for convenience sake. You know, they can trade it. It's a lot. There's, you know, unlike buying a physical piece of metal where there's maybe some carrying costs and transaction costs, it's easier to point and click and get in and out of a position. What I found kind of interesting with SLV and as well as GLD, and I put some of this also on my Twitter page as well, is that this move in the markets that we saw from February on up to today, for example, you didn't see any increase in share issuance, meaning when how ETFs operate is if more people are buying the ETF, a lot of times the authorized participant who's in charge of creating and redeeming shares, if a lot of people are buying those shares, all of a sudden the shares can go to a premium, for example, to its net asset value. It provides incentive to the authorized participant to deliver actual physical silver, get more shares, because basically the physical silver is cheaper at that point than the underlying shares. So there's an arbitrage. They can deliver cheap silver, get overpriced shares, sell those shares into the market and capture a profit. And what you were seeing basically during the February, March, April run-up is net from beginning to, you know, February to today, for example, there hasn't been any shares increasing in the fund, meaning there's been no silver delivered to the fund, which I thought was really strange in that silver just made a massive breakout on the charts through 26. And you're seeing absolutely no interest whatsoever. And at least when you're looking at shares outstanding, you're not seeing any interest from institutional investors, high net worth investors, or, you know, retail investors. It's almost as if everyone's just ignoring it. And so when you start to lift the hood up a little bit, what you're seeing is a massive increase in short interest and short sales volume that's actually been happening. And market makers have the ability to sell shares short and even naked short to basically meet that buying volume. They can sell when everybody else is buying. A lot of times they do that because they can either make money from an arbitrage, or they have inventory that they're unloading, or they can make money on spreads. But that's what was actually meeting the demand, not necessarily just simply going, you know, authorized participants seeing all this buying. Because if you look at the volume, the daily volumes on SLV and GLD, they are just been absolutely off the charts. I mean, that you look at, especially when we just saw last week when you had that big sort of reversal price action, you had over 100 million shares traded in SLV in one day. And so you've been seeing a lot of volume and interest in the SLVs, and a lot of it's trading. I get it. But not all of it is just simply trading. It's not people buying and selling and getting out at the end of the day. There are people that do buy and hold, but that just wasn't really being represented here.
Yeah. Explain the concept of this basically financial sponge, because as you mentioned, normally when there's a lot of interest in an asset class, I don't care if you call it AI stocks, whatever's going up, more people start going, traders start going into that asset class or that particular stock or ETF, because since hitting a low right around, let me just see here on the chart. So right around February, it got down to a low in the just slightly below $22, and then it went up almost to 30. Bob, you're talking about a 32% increase in a short period of time. So you would think with that kind of interest and that kind of price move, there would be a lot more shares that would be issued coming into this ETF. That hasn't happened. So explain this sponge and how it's used, how shorting is used to take care of this.
Yeah. Okay. So to take a step back, just as a refresher, you have the ETF SLV, and the gatekeeper to the market is what they call the authorized participant. And those are the big banks, you know, names you're probably very familiar with, you know, Goldman Sachs is trading, or JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley. There's a lot of big names that basically their role is to create and redeem shares, and they get paid on the arbitrage. For example, if the, like I said, if the price or the NAV of the share price should correlate with the underlying asset. But when you get these price fractures where the underlying asset is cheaper or more expensive than the net asset value of the fund, there are times where these authorized participants can add liquidity or remove liquidity to try to balance out that share price. And so it works rather well by design, because it incentivizes the authorized participants to help make a liquid market for that ETF. But what gets interesting here is when there is a massive demand for an ETF and the underlying asset or the number of ounces that are in that fund or the number of shares outstanding in that fund doesn't react to the volume that's actually being seen on a day-to-day basis, you have to look at other types of measures. And as market makers, authorized participants are also market makers. And then there's also market makers outside the authorized participant activity. And as market makers help the shares when they're traded on the open market. And so if there's a lot of demand from retail investors, those market makers can help, not necessarily the authorized participants, but the market makers can help offset that activity. Like if there's a wave of buying that comes in and there's just no sellers, the market makers can expose themselves and sell shares that they may not own or have or borrowed in a way to maintain an orderly market. And then they can obviously go in and arbitrage, or they can use other instruments to try to hedge themselves. And that that's where you get into, you know, options and other types of instruments. And that's where you can get into short squeezes and things like that, gamma squeezes and that type of thing. But staying out of that area for the moment here, what happens is, in order to meet this demand, if there's true demand out there for silver, for example, if the authorized participant has to go out into the market, get silver, deliver the silver to the fund, even if there's an arbitrage opportunity for them to do it, if the silver is tight and it's expensive, it may not incentivize them to do that. And so in order to maintain an orderly market, there's an ability to short shares into the market with the idea that, okay, if you get a pullback, you can cover those shares, or you can somehow hedge those with other instruments, whether it's a futures market or whatever it may be. But it's a way to try to maintain an order where you the NAV stays somewhat stable to the underlying security that ETF is holding, if that makes sense.
It sure does. And, you know, here's something I want to talk about. Something here that really struck me last Saturday, and that is individual investor demand. And Bob, explain to me why you have not very much buying of silver, except for if you go to Costco. Costco, I think you and I were talking about this. We talked last week. Costco, I think, sold $200 million worth of gold and silver, and you think part of that was jewelry. But I went into Costco Saturday, hoping to pick up because Costco was selling it for like 2% above spot. And I talked to the guy and he says, look, we only get a delivery once a week for security reasons. They never tell us when it's coming in. And when it comes in, it's sold out within the first hour or two. And he was telling me, we actually have people waiting outside the store. The store opens at 10 o'clock, hoping that they'll get a shipment of gold and silver that day. So explain to me what's going on with the ETFs or the dishoarding of silver and SLV over the last couple of years, and explain now what's going on with Costco selling silver. I mean, as soon as they get it, it's gone within an hour or two. You wouldn't think of Costco as a bullion dealer, but they're one of the largest sellers of gold and silver in the country right now.
I don't think that 200 million number is all gold bars, because I don't think they sell the PAMP gold bar, which is a beautiful gold bar, but I don't think PAMP can make $200 million of gold 1 ounce bars a month. So that's why I think some of that is more jewelry related. But that's not to get into the details of that. But to give you a little bit of backdrop that sort of made this popular at Costco is that the industry, the last 3 years, really since 2020, did a very big disservice to the consumer by marking up premiums on products to a point which became very prohibitive and very penalizing. And you just basically the last 6 or 8 months, you've seen the premiums just collapse in the industry. And so investors have kind of woken up and said, listen, if I'm going to buy a couple bars from instead of going online to my favorite online dealer who was charging me, you know, 8-10% over spot to buy a gold bar or a gold coin, whatever it may be, I'm just going to go to Costco. It's more convenient. And I get that. It makes total sense. The problem the industry's having, though, is people are arbitraging and going to Costco, buying the gold bar, and then trying to sell it back into the industry and make money off of whatever the 2% cash back if they do it on a credit card or they get the 2% cash back as a member. There's ways that the public, there are a lot of smart people out there, and they're realizing, yeah, there's a way to actually make some money doing this. So some of that is actually that, not necessarily people just buying and holding on to it. And it's part of what the industry really has to help, I think, repair is the trust of, hey, listen, you have spread risk, you have, you know, the premiums, the cost to buy, and then you have the cost to sell. And what you've seen here is the bids are what people are selling back to the industry, the metals that they had purchased. They're seeing discounts to spot that are actually relatively very large. And that has turned a lot of people off. And so retail investment has really died down in physical bars and coins the last 6 months. And you've seen a lot of net selling coming into the market. And that's what's impacted the premiums. What's interesting that we have right now is a moment in time where people that have been holding metals for 15 years or 5 years, whatever that time frame is, the markets are breaking out and they don't even trust the rally. A lot of people have been selling into this rally thinking, okay, we're going to get the pop up in silver. It's going to get to 26, 28, and it's going to fall all the way back down to 22 again. I can sell here, I can rebuy, and I can make money. And maybe turn this into an investment rather than, you know, some sort of long-term drain on my portfolio or just an aggravating type of a hold position. So people have been selling into this rally, not believing it. And that's what you want to see, oddly enough, is this growing wall of worry. And we may have talked about this last time, but if the ETFs are seeing that exact same thing, which I doubt it, but if the ETFs are seeing absolutely no interest whatsoever and people dumping their positions into this rally, to me, as the world is buying metal, China has been a big buyer, India has been a big buyer, people don't understand this is a global story. It's not a U.S.-centric story. And one of the things that tips me off with regard to the ETFs, the SLV and GLD, and you see this lack of any shares outstanding, any growth of that, is if you look at the European ETFs, ETCs, they've seen dramatic increases in their position holdings. I mean, institutions are buying silver over there, unlike the U.S. And I find that kind of interesting because, a lot of portfolio managers, a lot of money management firms around the world are competitive with one another. And they're not. And if an asset is taking off, I don't think you're going to have a large asset company here in the States totally ignore that price action. So that's what makes me, again, believe that the metal has built sort of a storyline to it, that you have a lot of frustrated investors not trusting a rally at the same time. And maybe that could be the reason why a lot of market makers and so forth are shorting, or a lot of participants are shorting the ETFs thinking, okay, this is just going to fall flat on its face again. But time will tell.
Let's talk about gold itself. So the story has been China has been a large buyer, and there's a number of reasons why I think gold is going much higher, whether it's the perception of a growing U.S. government default on treasuries. We're
almost up to $35 trillion. Annualized borrowing interest on that debt is about $1.2 trillion. You've got the BRIC countries that are going to a non-US dollar payment system using gold. You've got countries that have seen the dollar weaponize. I'm thinking of Russia right now. And then you also have some insolvency. I mean, if you take a look at the losses on the Fed's balance sheet, over $120 billion. So a number of reasons there. But you discovered something that really surprised you. And I wonder if you'd share that with our listeners. And that is the belief that China has been, we keep hearing there's a mystery buyer out there. And then so everybody's thinking, oh, it's got to be China. And you found out something a little different. Explain that for our listeners.
Yeah, not to get into the conspiracy world, but a lot of metal was obviously going to China. And it was in the export numbers in Switzerland. It was in the export numbers of London. It wasn't disguised. I mean, there was a lot of buying, especially also going to India as well. But the metal was actually being marked up, or basically the price of the metals were allowed to rise and break out to make that metal more expensive to the Chinese banks as they were buying it and then selling it back to their citizens. And the reason that metal was being marked up was to basically remove excess liquidity as investors buy metals in a country, no matter what it is. Basically, what they're doing is they're taking money out of the system and they're hoarding it through gold. And so it tends to be a negative economic event because it's removing liquidity. And so what I understand here is that by marking up gold and silver with all this massive demand from the Chinese, it basically made that metal more expensive, which means it took out that much more excess liquidity from the pockets of buyers. And the idea behind that would be if China was trying to reinflate their economy, making maybe this asset more expensive, which has been seeing tremendous demand, would have less money available for those consumers to spend on other products or construction or energy, for example, for vehicles, whatever it may be. But it tends to sap liquidity. And in return, by marking up those products, having China less liquidity because more currency has to go in to buy this metal, it would then reduce the demand for those other products like copper and so forth, which would then help us in the U.S. put less strain on our commodity prices, for copper and other types of energy, whatever it may be, oil, which would help keep our inflation under control. And so it's kind of this is the way the world works type of scenario, but it's the kind of stuff that you never really, it takes like five chess moves on a board to understand this kind of stuff. But that's just how the power that, when you're the world's reserve currency and most of the money in the system around the world flows through the U.S. markets, that's the kind of power and control you can have. And that starts to make more sense when you start understanding why wasn't there more metal being put into the ETFs? Why were there more shares being shorted to meet demand? Because that metal was being shifted or sent to China, basically. There's a lot of metal being sent there.
Yeah, and let's talk about, you have two charts, which we're going to put up on our website. They're the short interest in SLV and the short interest in GLD. And the short interest that we're seeing right now in SLV, I mean, it looks like a NASA space launch. So let's address that.
Yeah, that started to take off in late February, early March. And that's when, if you look at volume on SLV, very similar. You saw the trading volume start to pick up, and trading volume kind of commemorates with short sales volume. And a lot of times, market makers, when they short to meet demand, when they buy back that position in the open market to cover that short, that may be included in short sales volume as well. But I just found it interesting that you saw a move in the markets that you typically see when prices are crashing or near lows, not necessarily when they're breaking out. I mean, I don't know anybody who would want to be shorting something on a verge of a massive breakout. I mean, gold breaking when it broke through 2100 or whatever, and it had force and volume behind it. To be short that would be financial suicide. But yet you were seeing this massive increase in this sales volume. Typically, you got to have deep pockets if you're going to be shorting an asset class that's absolutely breaking out from, you know, to new all-time highs.
And that's the thing that, you know, at some point, people don't realize how small the gold and silver market is, and especially silver when you compare to other asset classes like the global bond market, the global equity market, or just the U.S. equity market alone. So when money starts to go in to something that's so small, I think if you took the market cap of all the world's miners, base metals, gold, silver miners, it doesn't even come close to a company like Apple, Google, or any of the Magnificent Seven. They're a fraction of what those companies are worth.
Yeah, and yeah, especially if you're a large asset management company and you're saying you want to put maybe 0.5%, you know, you're trying to switch things around, you're seeing the markets go up in the precious metals world, and you say, okay, I want to get exposure to that. Let me stick 0.5% of my $1 trillion of assets that they may have. You would basically buy out all the miners. I mean, just one fund. I mean, it is a very, very small market. And you know, if they ever even wanted to get physical exposure, which most of them don't, because they don't really get paid on, there's some regulatory requirements that may stop them from actually going into the market and buying physical. They have to go into a fund or a security or some type of security instrument or derivative. But you're right. It's a very, very small market. You know, one also thing that your listeners will probably want to focus on, which I put this out also on my Twitter, was the borrowing fee rate on GLD. It just started to move higher today, meaning it's getting more expensive to borrow shares or the fee to borrow those shares. And that's another sign to watch for as you know, you start to see tightness in the expensiveness in borrowing shares. You tend to see the amount of availability of shares start to drop rather quickly. That's something that sometimes is a lead in to higher prices as well.
Yeah, and especially when you are short. I've seen silver short positions 25, 30 times the amount of silver available for delivery. Now, most of the time in the futures market, CTAs, they're trading this stuff. They don't intend to take delivery, pay storage fees, things of that nature. So it's a trading vehicle. Whether it's futures or even sometimes in the ETFs. But when you short to this magnitude and all of a sudden, you know, I'm just thinking of how bull markets work. You know, the first phase of a bull market, the smart money gets in. The second phase, the institutions get in. And the third phase, it's the public. And so as you just mentioned, if I was running a mutual fund company, I'm Fidelity, I'm Vanguard, whoever, any of the large funds, and I want to take a position. I mean, if you take a look at my business, 95% of the IRAs out there, I doubt if they own gold. And so when that market wakes up and says, we got to be a part of it, it is so small that you get these violent moves. You could see gold up several hundred bucks in a single week. You could see silver up, as we just talked about, in a short period of time. It's up over 30%. So that's why we have always said you got to be in it to win it, because it's such a micro, small market in comparison to the other asset markets. But more importantly, one of the things we're interested in, and one of the ways we've had for our clients, Bob, to get around, because I can remember on Kitco at one point, I think the premiums on Silver Eagles got up to as almost 80%. So you would almost have to get a double in the price of silver to make up for a coin that you just bought.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate thing. And I've seen that type of activity amongst retail dealers, not just in Eagle products, but other products as well. It's unfortunate because people are trying to protect themselves. They may understand the story, but it's how they actually own the product. That's a whole different animal to sort of digest. You really have to understand the nuances of these products, who you're buying from. Try to understand and talk to as many people as possible. Shop around. That's the best thing you can do. It's really a buyer beware market. There is no regulation when it comes to the physical metals markets. You know, one other thing to mention on, because you were mentioning it's, you know, how small the securities markets are of gold and silver. The physical markets dwarf that. I mean, they're very tiny. You could, you can really sway a market. What we haven't seen in this environment, which has started to show itself, was the physical demand has been sort of what has in the past, when you get these sell on the big market event drops, the physical demand tends to be the stabilizing factor that creates support. What you're seeing now, though, is the physical demand is actually driving some of this price action and really take over price discovery. That's something we haven't really seen. I mean, some people will say, well, what's the difference between this and the silver squeeze movement in 2021? Well, in 2021, what you saw there wasn't necessarily a silver squeeze. It was a premium squeeze. Products got tight, but like I was telling people, it's trying to move the lumber market by buying 2x4s at Home Depot. In this environment, what you're seeing is large size bars, the 1,000-ounce silver bars, really are the asset of choice. And that's actually what dictates a lot of these different swap ratios, exchange for premium spreads and things like that. That tends to have more immediate impact than simply 1 ounce silver eagles or 1 ounce rounds.
That's exactly what we had to do for our clients that wanted to own silver, because there's no way I could justify paying 50 to 80% premium for silver. So we were buying 1,000-ounce bars. And one of the other things too that really struck us is, and we're going to post this, I wrote an article in 2020 talking about get ready for inflation, because we were seeing the inflationary forces that were coming into play with COVID, shutting down, the government handing out checks. And Bob, I don't know anybody that really believes inflation is running at 3 or 4%. It's probably running in reality about 5 or 6% above that. But you're seeing on the macro front, coalition of different forces that are coming into play in the precious metals market. And then on top of that, you're seeing two of the biggest mines were off production. We have declining production in Mexico, the world's largest silver producer. Their reserves could run out in 5 or 6 years. You're seeing it also in China. And then at the same time, we're pushing this green revolution that's going to require more use of silver, which is going to be consumed, not to mention all our electronic devices we have today, from our iPhones to our iPads to our laptops.
Yeah, and I think the Silver Survey, World Survey came out talking about, you know, this idea of ever-increasing, you know, continued supply deficits, declining production schedules in the mining sector overall, not just in specific countries, but actually broader based. I mean, you've seen it in Peru and Chile and Australia. So it's becoming, yeah, the inflation that's impacting investors and their reasons to buy metals. Well, that inflation is actually impacting the mining companies and their ability to be profitable mining gold and silver. In fact, a lot of these primary silver producers are now primary gold producers. They just can't make money. They weren't able to make money in silver at $23 an ounce. And I think that adds to the persona of, well, wait a second, we're talking about an asset here that's still priced at the same price it was back in 1979, but all the equipment they're using, you know, that's vastly inflated. You have some interesting dynamics.
Yeah, I can see at some point when this massive short position, when they're going to have to cover, even you take the Wall Street banks themselves, everyone from Goldman is talking about $2,700 gold. You got people like UBS talking about $3,400 gold. I haven't seen Wall Street investment banks putting out forecasts for gold. Now, granted, they're forecast, and we all know what can happen to a forecast. I mean, if we were to take them as gospel in terms of the way we invest, it's a good way to lose money because a lot of these forecasts never materialize. But nonetheless, you now have interest coming from institutions, which is, in my opinion,
the second phase or the beginning of the second phase of a bull market, it begins with the smart money that goes in first, and then it transfers to the institutions, and we're starting to see a bit of that. Any comments there?
No, you're absolutely right. That is sort of the bread and butter, or the I guess how the genesis of how these moves tend to operate. You know, one other thing for people that are short-term focused, if you look at the move back in 2011 in the silver market when it took off, and you had a lot of that move in silver when it went from, you know, 30 on up to 50 in a very short period of time, a lot of that was actually derivative action. The futures market, basically the roll between the May contract to the July contract, and you saw this big move in actual April of 2011. Well, you're seeing the same thing potentially unfold here as you get closer and closer to the end of April, which now, you know, when you go into May, you're now in that delivery month, and if you're short, you could actually be you could control whether you have to deliver or not. But if you're short, you're normally going to have to roll out of that position and short, say, the July contract. So you're going to have to buy back your near-term contract and short your longer-dated contract. And there's strategies why they do that. But in essence, so in April of 2011, people were trying to get out of their short positions, and that was creating this massive one-sided sort of pressure to the upside. And you could see that it'll be interesting the next 2 weeks how that actually plays out, because you have to remember, you know, the CME's raising margin requirements. They're seeing potential volatility coming into the market and try to, you know, a lot of times they're trying to remove that volatility by increasing margins. You know, that could actually have a magnifier effect, especially if you're on the short side trying to get out. Now it's making it more expensive to carry that position. So those are some of the sort of day-to-day and sort of nuances to watch for as the short-term story unfolds. But you're right, the long-term story, I think, you know, by next year, we see much higher gold prices, silver prices. I think, you know, my sort of projection is that we retest the all-time highs and break through those. I think there could be a surge that happens. And then from there, as, you know, a money manager, you start to look at the gold and silver market and say, okay, relative to its value to other assets, where is it now placed at? Because there will be a time where prices get too out of hand, or maybe the relative valuation gets too expensive relative to something else. But you're right. We're still in sort of this early phase.
I want to cover one final point as we close here. We covered this last time you were on the program. Let's talk about Basel III and what this means for the unwinding of derivative positions for major banks.
Yeah, the Basel III, basically what it kind of did was centralized risk and try to remove leverage from banks' balance sheets, especially with regard to unallocated gold positions, where they were basically using their balance sheet as the backing of when a client wanted to buy gold. They would sell them gold in an unallocated form, but they wouldn't necessarily own gold themselves. They would maybe use their balance sheet to basically pay them out in cash, you know, when the client wants to leave. That practice went on for a very, very long time. And it was very, very fruitful because, you know, they didn't have reserve requirements. You know, they could take in those clients' funds that wanted to buy gold and then potentially use those funds for their own purposes to grow their balance sheet and then make it back up to the client when they wanted to leave, or if they, you know, if there was a program to take gold, they could go out into the market and buy gold. Well, when they started to put in these reserve requirement ratios where you had to pony up 85% of whatever the client deposited, it kind of removed that incentive. What was interesting too is that the banks are being focused to or incentivized to hold more U.S. treasuries in their balance sheet. And I think that's the bigger picture here, that banks are going to be, instead of investing money into the economy or into other assets, they're going to be incentivized to actually just buy more U.S. treasuries, which is going to basically tie the banking system and the U.S. government together even more at the hip and potentially, you know, magnify systemic risk. That's where I'm kind of focusing on. And I think when bigger players look at this picture and they start to say, listen, tell me about precious metals, you know, when they're doing their research and say, okay, we got to get some exposure. Most of these institutions, they're thinking they can buy gold and silver and have it in ETF form or have it in some sort of paper structured form. And they got, you know, a hedge, or they got, all they're doing is buying exposure to price. They're not really buying what the metal, the physical metal actually represents, which is a true hedge against systemic and counterparty risk. That's the story that I like to tell people, is that the reason why you want to own physical metal is it's no one else's promise to pay. You don't have that in a security. There is no way to really diversify from systemic risk in paper instruments.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Bob, I just want to let our listeners know your article, How Does the Market System Manage the Silver Price, with diagrams and explanation. We're going to put that on our website. We're also going to put some of your charts showing the short interest in gold and silver, and we're going to have that up on our website. And then two other articles I want to put up on our website is an article I wrote in March of 2020, warning about what was going to happen to oil, and then in April of 2020, warning, get ready, inflation is coming. So we're going to have all of that on the website. In the meantime, Bob, as we close, how can our listeners find out more about your company? You're one of the smartest people I know in the gold business.
Yeah, we do a lot of work. We're one of the largest private depositories in the country. We store $700 million in assets. We work with a lot of high net worth, ultra high net worth clients, as well as retail clients as well for IRAs and that type of thing. We buy and sell metals through wholesalers. We make two-way markets. We also provide armored logistics and transportation. I run, just for full disclosure, I run a hedge fund in physical metals. Roughly the weightings are about 78% silver, 28% gold right now. So I see a lot of advantage to the silver market. And I see that, like you said, the gold-silver ratio very, very high, where that could come in and that could provide an extra degree of sort of alpha, I guess you could say, or performance. So if you're kind of late to the show or you don't have any exposure and you've already seen gold go to new all-time highs, yeah, I think institutions are starting to look at silver from a standpoint of, hey, listen, I'm not really playing catch up here. This thing is still where it was even back in 2021. So I do all that type of stuff. That's on our website, goldsilvervault.com. And then also, I'm also on Twitter or X, Profits Plus ID, P-R-O-F-I-T-S-P-L-U-S-I-D as in Idaho. And I put out a lot of great information there.
All right. Well, Bob, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Jim.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Or you can also visit us on our website, financialsensewealth.com. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.